Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
The XX Gab Fest is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron sends gourmet recipes and all the fresh ingredients you need to make them right to your door. To see what's on the menu this week, visit BlueApron.com. And our listeners get their first two meals free. Just go to blueapron.com/XX. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, September 4th, the Fill the Dirndl edition. I'm Hannah Rosen in the D.C. studio, and I'm joined in New York by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And also Noreen Malone, an editor at New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Before we get going, I want to respond to some of our listeners. June, the email this week was full of love for your voice. It was basically, I would do anything that June tells me to do. Wow. So I think we should make them do some stuff, really. We should up with stuff.
Could they do my homework for me?
Exactly. We could do better than that. But I want to read a letter from Rick Alfaro, who responded to the segment on low-wage workers and unpredictable work hours. And he writes, in my mind, the big problem is not how the lower-end service industry schedules their employees. The problem is that the social function of these jobs has fundamentally changed. When I was working in the food service, there were very few people who were over the age of 25 and even fewer who had children or families to support. I thought this was a really interesting point. He writes, these jobs were never intended to support families. They were entry-level positions. And I remember that when I was a kid, that the people you'd find working at such jobs were like teenage kids, right? Like nobody ever thought of them as jobs that were intended to support families. So that was a great point. So our three topics for this week. First, we're going to talk about the post-clinic abortion. A renegade figures out clever ways to let women do their own abortions in places where the practice is illegal. Second, the NFL gets tough on domestic violence. Has sports gone all feminist on us? And finally, in her new book, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand declines to name her colleagues who supposedly harassed her. Should she name her colleagues? Okay, let's start with our first topic. We have a special guest this week to discuss it with us, Emily Bazelon. In this week's New York Times Magazine, Emily Bazelon has a cover story about Rebecca Gompertz, Dutch doctor who's pushing the limits of abortion law. Gompertz started out by sailing to countries where abortion was illegal and transporting women to international waters to do the procedure. Now she does it through a group called Women on Web, which sends women pills that induce a miscarriage. Is this the future of abortion, Emily asks? Should we think about doing this in the U.S., in states where the politics just gets too complicated. Emily Bazelon, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. So I want to start by just an explanation of what these pills are and how they work for people who haven't read a lot about them.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the pills used to be called RU486, and you might remember it from those days. In the Clinton presidency, there was a big fight about whether the Food and Drug Administration should approve RU486, and it was indeed approved. It's now called mifepristone, and it was approved by the FDA, but with a lot of restrictions that make it relatively hard to access in the United States. There is a second drug called misoprostol. It goes by a bunch of brand names, but that's the name of the actual drug. And if you take mifepristone and misoprostol together over a 24-hour period, they are between 95% and 98% effective in inducing a miscarriage, so causing an abortion that feels like a miscarriage, during the first trimester.
And so what situations were women were in who wanted to get these pills? Like, what's the circumstance in which it becomes a useful thing to ship these pills out to people?
Well, there are a few different circumstances. One is that you can go to a clinic and have a choice about whether to have a surgical abortion or a medical abortion with these pills. Abortion opponents call it a chemical abortion, but doctors use the term medical abortion. And it means that instead of having, you know, what we think of as a DNC with surgical instruments, instead you take these pills under a doctor's supervision. Sometimes they give you the misoprostol to take it home, and then you miscarry. And that can be pretty painful and uncomfortable, depending on how far along you are and just like your individual body. Or if you're really early in your pregnancy and you're lucky, it can be that not that big a deal. So that's one possibility for these pills. A second possibility, which is more what I was writing about, is the idea that you live in a country where abortion is illegal or severely restricted, but you've heard about these pills and you are desperately trying to get your hands on them. And you can order them online. The problem is there's a big black market out there, and you usually don't know if you're getting the real drugs. And there's a lot of confusion about what the dosages are. So the doctor I was focusing on for the magazine, Rebecca Gompertz, has set up a system where she has doctors prescribing the medication after reviewing women's online medical histories. They fill out a consultation. And then the prescriptions go to a drug exporter in India who Dr. Gompertz trusts to send out high-quality medication. So it's this kind of complicated international jerry-rigged system for mailing packages of pills all over the world to women who live in countries where it's illegal for them to be taking the drugs.
I couldn't quite settle. Like, on the one hand, like, you described it very soberly and calmly, and it seems like Gompertz, everyone who's involved is like a doctor and knows what they're doing, and the procedure seems incredibly painful, but manageably painful. And yet there's this like incredible renegade spirit behind this whole operation. I couldn't quite tell where we were on the line of like, this is dangerous. I mean, it seemed amazing. Like, it seemed like, given the way the world is and how we treat abortion, particularly in certain countries, this was an unbelievably brave and clever operation to have set up. But was it in any way scary? That's what I couldn't decide.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Rebecca Gompertz is like an old-fashioned radical. And in a lot of ways, what she's doing reminds me the most of this heralded feminist group called the Jane Collective, which in the late 60s and early 70s in Chicago was a group of women. They weren't doctors. They trained themselves to do surgical abortions in the first trimester, and they offered them to women, you know, as cheaply as possible. Some of them got prosecuted for doing this, and then those criminal charges got dropped after Roe versus Wade passed. I mean, after it was ruled by the Supreme Court, and there was no longer supposed to be a need for this kind of underground feminist do-it-yourself abortion. But Gompertz's argument is that when you look at the choices women are facing abroad, the pills she is providing are much, much safer than the alternatives. And there are numbers to back her up. You know, the World Health Organization estimates that 47,000 women around the world still die every year from unsafe abortions. I think for me, the sort of tipping point in working on the story was that I have a good friend who is an obstetrician gynecologist who performs abortions, and who is like very much in the medical professional mainstream, someone with like lots of degrees and training. And when I first started working on this piece, I called her and I asked her what she thought about this whole Women on Web endeavor. And I expected her to be skeptical because it seemed so much like an end run around the medical establishment. And maybe too risky. And instead, she said, you know, if you look at the literature, the medical literature about harm and risk, there's just no question that this is a much lower risk than an unsafe abortion or, you know, in a lot of ways than childbirth, because that in itself poses a danger to women. And in the countries that Gompertz is really focused on, there's a pretty high risk often of maternal mortality from unsafe abortion or from childbirth. And so when you look at all those numbers in a kind of cold, hard way, you can come to the conclusion that while this does have some risk inherent in it, it's lower than the alternative.
One of the things that struck me, Emily, was that her being thousands of miles away sometimes from her patients felt kind of, I don't know if dangerous is the right word, but risky because they were so far away. But then, you know, it also struck me that one of the things we're doing in the U.S. is making clinics so distant sometimes that people are traveling great distances. And so that in practical terms, they're not really able to go to, you know, have a follow up or to go back to the doctor if anything goes wrong, or only with great difficulty. So while, yes, there is a sizable distinction between being 3,000 miles away from your patient and being 500 miles away sometimes, it's not, you know, it didn't feel to me that crazy as my first response felt.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that makes sense. I think also we're starting to have an era in which, you know, big organizations like the American Medical Association think more about telemedicine, not just or even primarily in the context of abortion, but in providing a range of medical services. And then I think every different kind of procedure has its own like cost-benefit analysis in terms of whether telemedicine is going to be safe and is going to work. And the argument for the women on web approach is definitely tied to what you're saying, June, which is that if women do experience complications, they have to rely on their local medical services, their own doctor or the emergency room or whatever for care, and that is standard, that in fact, even when you can go back to your clinic, clinics don't provide 24-hour emergency care usually. And the kind of standard arrangement is if something goes wrong, you just like call your doctor or you go to the ER, and then maybe you can, you know, refer back to the clinic, but maybe not. And that's part of this other battle we're having in the United States over whether abortion providers have to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. But one of the arguments against that particular restriction is that it's just not medically necessary because women do receive care in a kind of standard way from local health providers.
You know, you didn't take it this far, Emily, but I was thinking maybe one day we will consider this a better alternative, even in places where abortion is readily accessible, partly because we like convenience. We like everything to be delivered. And also in that, you know, Boston Health Collective, our bodies ourselves kind of spirit that women can take care of their own bodies and do their own things and in a kind of protest against the patriarchal medical establishment spirit. I wondered if this could ever become standard of care.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons I wrote this piece was exactly to spark that kind of conversation. I don't think we know all the answers yet, but it's really interesting to think about. And of course, you can also push back against this, right? I mean, for 40 years, the pro-choice movement has been arguing that abortion is a decision, a choice between a woman and her doctor, and has located abortion primarily in clinics that specialize in this service. And in their own way, we're supposed to be like feminist progress because women were being taken care of and getting what they needed. The problem, of course, is that the physical clinics have become such a target for abortion opponents, and lately for these restrictions that are really about shutting clinics by kind of strangling them with expensive regulations. And so now the notion of going back to a kind of DIY world where you would take all this out of the political spotlight seems like it could have some real innate appeal. And yet to women, to people who own and run clinics and have devoted their lives to this, this is a totally maddening development that feels very backwards to them.
Because, I mean, Women on Web is the most legitimate of these organizations, right? There are also people who are just sort of selling pills just over the border in Mexico that women in Texas are driving to go get, right? Like it's part of a spectrum of this kind of abortion that's happening. And this is like the most legitimate way, but it's a little worrisome to me to see the other things that go along with this.
Oh, absolutely. totally. I mean, I would say it's the only legitimate way to get the pills online that I know about. I mean, it could be that there are other online sellers of these pills that are sending the pills and sending enough information about how to take them properly, but I'm not aware of that. And in fact, Women on Web hears reports from women who write in all the time complaining and reporting about scam sites. And so there's a list you can go to on the Women on Web website that has a long list of sites that they're warning women against. So you're absolutely right. There's this like split about whether, you know, what's called self-induction or DIY abortion with these pills is actually like a scary backward step, or whether there's a way to do it safely the way Gompertz is doing that could be some kind of sign of progress.
Emily, I wondered if, you know, given your legal background, as I was reading your story, I was really struck by the, you know, a great efficiency and safety of Mife and Miso as a treatment, and the fact that doctors who oppose it seem to be, you know, pro-life doctors, that is, seem to be ignoring science, and whether there might actually be some kind of legal challenge that, you know, we live in a country where abortion is legal, and yet science, you know, I don't know. As I'm even saying this, I'm realizing that, yeah, that's not how lawsuits work. But it just really feels like it really feels like it's wrong for, you know, scientifically efficient and safe treatments to be denied to women. And I don't know. Is there nothing that can be done about this in the U.S.?
Well, that's a really good question. So I guess there are different parts to answering that. Without going on forever. I guess the first thing I'd say is that there are 15 states that have enacted telemedicine abortion bans, and they're directly aimed at this kind of provision of service. And they're exactly the states that are also making it harder and harder for clinics to stay open. So that's like kind of problem number one, legally speaking. In particular, there was a program in Iowa where Planned Parenthood was using telemedicine to treat women in rural areas. So you would have a doctor in Iowa City, and he would or she would be like on, you know, video conference on closed circuit with the patient somewhere else. There'd be a nurse practitioner, someone like that, overseeing in person. And the doctor would consult with the patient, and then there's like a magic button the doctor would push that would open a drawer, and the woman would take out the pills and then take them. And that pilot project ran, and there was a big study of it. It had really safe and effective outcomes in terms of the complication rates and, you know, all of that. And then a few years ago, the Iowa Board of Medicine approved the program, but then a Republican governor ran for election, partly on a platform of dismantling it. He changed the composition of the board of the Iowa, the people on the Iowa Medical Board, and then they ruled that the program had to stop. And a judge in Iowa just agreed with the Iowa Medical Board and halted the program. So that's like a legal fight that's kind of brewing. And then I guess you could also think, and I flicked at this a little bit at the piece, about the national standards that the FDA has put in place that make mifepristone in particular very restricted. And should the federal government, given the evidence of safety and efficacy that's really pretty recent, should the FDA be rethinking its standards and just make it easier? One thing they could do is just make mifepristone prescription only, which it's not actually. At the moment, they're like all these hoops that doctors have to jump through in order to prescribe it.
Well, Emily, thank you for joining us today. And we encourage everyone to read the story. It is the cover of this weekend's New York Times Magazine. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Let's move on to our second topic, which is the NFL and domestic violence. But before we do that, I want to thank a brand new sponsor, Blue Apron. So I love to cook. I love to eat. I love to cook for my family. But if you're busy or you just don't know your way around a kitchen, which is not me, it can be very stressful because shopping takes time and cooking takes time and coming up with recipes takes time. So you should use Blue Apron. I happened to interview the founder of Blue Apron recently in New York at a panel, and so I checked it out and already used it, and it's awesome. I'm going to read you some of the things on the menu just this week, like chicken banh mi, which is delicious, and the one my daughter picked, which is smoky Swiss chard and black bean tostados. Such are the sophisticated tastes of children today. Here's how it works. For $9.99 a meal, they'll send the right ingredients in the exact right proportions with a simple recipe right to your door. Meals are 500 to 700 calories per servings, and they include step-by-step instructions with pictures. As Blue Apron says, they are idiot-proof, fast, fresh, and affordable. June, are you laughing because you're a kitchen idiot?
Yeah, I wonder if I could really test that.
Yeah. Anyway, if you sign up this week, you get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/XX. That's right, blueapron.com/XX. And you get two free meals if you are a GabFest listener. So go right away. Cook your family or yourself an extremely delicious meal. Okay. Last week, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced a new policy on domestic violence. He said that NFL employees whom the league determines to have committed acts of domestic violence will be subject to a 6-game suspension for the first offense and a lifetime ban for the second offense, although they'll have the option to reinstate players if they want to. This is much clearer and tougher than previous policies that the NFL has used and has us wondering, why did they do it? Is it really meaningful? Did the NFL have a domestic violence problem in the first place? So, Noreen, let's start with you. Do you have theories about why the NFL has become our feminist friends all of a sudden? Is it because Ray Rice is so awful? Sort of what led them to do this?
Well, actually, it was, I think it's more sports bloggers have become our feminist friends. You know, ever since this incident happened, I only barely skim the edges of sports Twitter and the sports internet just because I happen to be friends with a couple sports writers. And I've seen everywhere the fact that another player was suspended for longer for, you know, having two marijuana arrests, right? So it's become a real football fans, many of whom are men, are appalled by this, as they should be, that it's more, it's considered worse to be a toker, a pothead, than it is to be like a really like low down, dirty, awful wife beater. So Roger Goodell is sort of, you know, sticking a finger up to the wind and seeing which way it blows. My personal theory of Roger Goodell is that he is above all else a businessman. If you look at the way he's run the NFL, he has taken a huge business and made it even more huge. But one group of people who does not watch football as much as another group of people is women. And if you want to get women watching, you have to at least give lip service to the fact that you are concerned with the safety of the women who are married to these men.
Yeah, I definitely think that that is true. And I think that he has also gotten a lot of praise for, you know, I listen to sports radio a lot and I was talking like, oh, he really supports women. He heard all this feedback. He's really been responsive. And I think that's kind of a meta like benefit that he's getting, because I think although that there's truth to it, I think he's also trying to deflect attention from some other large problems that the NFL has, especially around concussion and to a lesser extent, perhaps the Washington D.C. football team's name. And I think that, you know, it's a little bit of let me get some positive publicity for doing something which is really correcting an egregious error, an egregious fault, so that then I'll, you know, be basking in this positive publicity and distract attention from these other big things.
And if you parse it, as a lot of people have done, it looks as if he actually hasn't changed anything. Right. The suspension rules before were essentially like at his discretion, and he has changed what the standard ought to be, but it still remains at his discretion. And he also did not negotiate this with the NFL Players Union, which is a very, very powerful organization. And so a lot of people are saying, well, like, this is just him putting out a press release. Who knows what will actually happen, you know, when this goes into effect, and especially 2 or 3 years down the line, maybe when the heat is off and there's just been this halo of goodwill around the NFL for having a zero tolerance policy, which actually is very, very malleable.
just to back up a little bit, I read an interesting story that Justin Peters wrote about a year ago analyzing the stats on domestic violence and the NFL. And it left me wondering whether, in fact, the NFL had higher rates of domestic violence than other places, or if this was purely a story about symbolism. So in Justin Peters' analysis, he said, I found that 21 of 32 NFL teams at one point this year had employed a player with a domestic violence or sexual assault charge on his record. That's a pretty striking factoid, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything statistically, because 2% of rostered NFL players in 2012 have been charged with an intimate violence crime, and that stacks up basically the same as the public at large and slightly lesser than the public at large. So you conclude that does the NFL basically sound like any institution where men work, you know, that there's a certain percentage of people who have domestic violence charges. So it's not necessarily fulfilling our stereotype that big, beefy men playing football are inherently abusive to women. It's just that the NFL has symbolically dealt so poorly with these issues. It's just that their players are famous and high profile and that they tend to very publicly excuse them. That's the problem.
Well,
not something inherent in the violence of football.
I also think there's more of a disincentive to report if your husband or boyfriend is a famous football player, or even not famous, just a very well-paid football player. I think it's – I mean, for a lot of women, there's a disincentive to report. But
especially in football, because they're not guaranteed contracts and they have short careers because of the, you know, the harshness of the sport. And so even more than any other sport, like losing your place on the team is really, really, really significant mm-hmm. to your financial well-being.
Well, people raise that about the new policy, which is that if you're facing a lifetime suspension from football, are you really, as a wife, going to report, or as a partner, going to report a second violation? You know, that's a really heavy penalty to play it. And so might it actually discourage women? That's a criticism that came up about the new policy.
It also just, I mean, this is not a politically correct thing to say, but it's a really violent sport. And the way that people get amped to play it, like, involves a lot of mind games with yourself and a lot of mind games with your team. And I would not be surprised if that does appear to spill over. You know, it's very, very hard for anyone to compartmentalize work and life. And when your work life involves just bashing people, I don't think it's totally crazy to think that you might be more inclined to attack a woman than another man might be who goes to the office and, you know, crunches spreadsheets all day.
So I was thinking that actually the really bad behavior and tolerance for bad behavior must happen in college, that the NFL players are under a certain amount of scrutiny, but that the college players just as a group are probably allowed to get away with a tremendous amount more bad behavior than other college students.
Yeah. And they're also of that age where boys just like have a lot of hormones and anger coursing through them. And
I imagine that in both the NFL and in college football, one issue is that the stars are treated differently from the journeymen or the, you know, the wannabes. I think we've seen that in recent cases in around college football. We also, you know, when Roger Goodell announced this new policy, he didn't do anything retroactive about Ray Rice because Ray Rice is a superstar and you know, and a guy who, despite this crime, which actually we should note, like, one of the things you were saying earlier, Noreen, about Roger Goodell having all of this autonomy, like Ray Rice was not found guilty of anything, you know.
And the woman married him, correct?
Yep,
she was engaged.
She was his fiance at the time. She married him. So, like, there is this sort of slightly creepy extrajudicial sort of element to Roger Goodell's power. I mean, I don't think anybody feels too worried about the Ray Rice incident because there is, you know, footage, there's film of, you know, the incident in the elevator, you know, with his then fiance. So, you know, not that it particularly, you know, makes people feel weird about the Ray Rice incident, but it is not something that we feel good about in America when somebody has power to control other people's livelihoods in a potentially, you know, just autonomous way. That makes us feel uncomfortable. However, we also, I think all of us, are very comfortable with it being, with that autonomous power being used to punish domestic violence and sexual assault perpetrators. However, it's also an uncomfortable process.
Do you mean, June, that they – you mean that the NFL is saying what they determine to be domestic violence? In other words, they're not waiting for an actual determination of guilt in a courtroom?
Right. Exactly. That's exactly the – you know, this personal conduct policy does allow for that and has been done repeatedly. You know, they take, you know, action without – on the basis of their own inquiries, not on any sort of criminal activities. You know, it's independent of the police and the courts. And that's just kind of uncomfortable, again, because it just allows people to, you know, treat stars differently. To when you hear the top line policy, it's six games and then it's forever. Well, maybe a year. And but really, there's so much leeway that it's a little feels a little bit like theater.
Yeah, I was imagining the NFL when it comes to a really star player manipulating the women in some way, you know, that if it's actually up to them, you know, domestic violence cases are always tricky. Even with non-famous people, it's extremely hard to get a woman to continue to testify in court and push through until the person actually gets prosecuted. If you have the NFL, which has a tremendous incentive for these guys to stay on the teams, you know, applying pressure in any way on these women, it seems like just a disaster without a legal court involved. And actually, if you think about it in terms of famous players, you know, the NFL tolerates a whole lot of bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they surely
Ray
do.
Lewis is like involved in the murder of someone and Ben Roethlisberger. And, you know, it's just the famous guys really get away with murder.
Do you guys watch the NFL? Having said all of this that we said, do you have any personal feelings about football, personal relationation to it?
I do not watch football.
But what do you listen to sports radio for?
I just like sports radio. I actually don't. Right now, I don't watch any sports on the regular, but I love to listen to sports radio. I enjoy it as broadcasting. But I am glad that I never really got into football because I really do think it is a creepy game at this point. I mean, it's basically guys really, really hurting themselves and each other.
Mm-hmm. Do you, Hannah?
I do not watch football, except when there's a very big game. Nobody in my house really is interested in football or watches that much football. So I watch a ton of soccer, even now, like Premier League games. I mean, just like endless soccer on the TV in my house, and some basketball, and there's not that much excitement around football. I was wondering about the class basis of football because I don't know, I don't have any friends whose children play football or who would let their children play football. And yet, in sort of suburban working class places, like I'm reporting a story right now in a high school which has like Friday Night Lights level football. I mean, they are insane about their football and everybody plays, and you know that there's like fireworks on the opening night, and so it's just like America. You could make a map of America, you know, football towns and baseball towns, and like baseball is a sort of elite upper class sport and football is what everybody else plays.
I think that's your East Coast bias showing. I'm from a, you know, relatively fancy town, but it's in Ohio, and my brothers played. I totally grew up in a football household. A lot of people in my like fancy suburb were into football.
Go Browns.
Well, I know, but I actually do not as an adult watch it at all, and I think it's in particular, the NFL is terribly gladiatorial. Like, literally, these stadiums are shaped like coliseums. The tickets are $800. It's rich white men watching, you know, black men who are making a lot of money right now but may not in the future and are, like, ruining their bodies in the process. It's the most gladiatorial thing we have going in America, and people are just all okay with that.
Man, I think we're showing our hand too much. It's like
no, but I'm from a football family. I can talk about it. I wish. And then when I hear East Coast people be like, "Well, soccer is, you know, that's the real football." Part of me is like, you don't even know. Like, it's a great sport. It's just like so. I have this very complicated relationship with it, where I think it is this truly American thing, but also it's awful, which is American.
So I guess all my football knowledge comes from Friday Night Lights. Embarrassing that. Oh, boy. Okay, well, now I feel like we must leave this topic because we have betrayed ourselves to know nothing about football. So let's move on to politics, which we know a whole lot about, right?
That's what we're telling our employers.
That's what we're telling them. In her new book, Off the Sidelines, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand tells some unflattering stories about her male colleagues. In the gym one day, one of them told her, "Good thing you're working out because you wouldn't want to get porky." On another occasion, she writes, after she dropped 50 pounds, one of her fellow Senate members approached her, squeezed her stomach, and said, "Don't lose too much weight now. I like my girls chubby." Gillibrand says these guys were older and didn't know what they were talking about, but people are calling her out to name her so-called harassers, and then other people say, no way. Why should the onus always be on the harassed to take the risk? I don't know where to begin with this one. Should we?
well, we should begin with the gender of the people who are telling her to name her harassers, which is, as far as I can tell, only men have been like, oh, you should definitely call them out. And this is their big feminist stance, saying, like, you should call them out. And every woman who's written about it, I was in a meeting where we were talking about how to cover this, and there was some guy who said that, and every woman in the room just chimed in, like, are you kidding? Like, she's got to work with these guys. What good is that going to do? Why would she have to do that? It seems to me like it's breaking down pretty clearly along gendered lines.
Yeah. And why do you think in this case the women think it's not important for her to name her? And I am kind of hesitating. I mean, now I'm showing my hand, but in calling them harassers, like I'm not even sure I want to take it that far. I think that word has specific resonance and meaning, which I'm not 100% sure is applicable in this case. But let's call them her harassers. Like, why do you think the women just think it's like if she were raped, they would say call them out, right? Like, does it have to do with the degree of what happened, or does it have to do with the hassle that she would have to face?
I think it's a combination. The social reality is that she works in an environment that's 100 people, the vast majority of which are older, wealthy, white men, right? And she wants to accomplish a lot of things in that office. She has also, I think it's safe to say, greater ambitions in that office. And, you know, why should she make her life more difficult? What good is she going to do by saying, hey, you know, Harry Reid? No, I'm not saying it was Harry Reid, but by calling out a specific guy, making this whole news cycle about that incident, and what's she going to get out of that? And I don't think she's actually going to change a lot of people's minds. I don't think that her Senate colleagues are really going to get all that more enlightened.
I have to say, though, I did have a little bit of a, I mean, I agree absolutely with what you're saying. At the same time, a part of me feels like, well, I had two big reactions. The first is she's one of like the 109 most important people in this country, and she still has to put up with dumb shit like this. was reaction number one. But reaction number two was like, I'm kind of now wondering exactly, I mean, so there's 80 guys that it could be, mm-hmm. I guess, or was it not just some? Maybe there's more, because maybe also members of the House could use this gem. I'm not sure. But it's like, which one is it? I'm kind of now I'm suspicious of all these guys, and I kind of want to know. I mean, I agree with you, Hannah, that, you know, as sins go, this one seems more kind of boneheaded and tin-eared, and also is the kind of sin that a very attractive, now skinny woman can sort of confess that, oh, you know, when I was still carrying the baby weight, these guys said things to me. It feels like a kind of a very calculated kind of story to tell. And I would be much more interested in the less palatable stories that she may probably has. But now I'm like, I feel a little bit like the guys in the Senate have been put under suspicion. And I wonder if she kind of should maybe indicate, well, it wasn't him. You know, can I just go around? Was it him? No. Was it him? No.
But why should her life get harder because some asshole who doesn't have manners or boundaries pinched her waist?
Yeah, you know? I absolutely agree. And yet I sort of think maybe she shouldn't have told the story if she wasn't going to go into more detail. I mean, I know, I agree, and I feel bad for having these thoughts, and I certainly care more about her than the potential, let's call them harassers, but I feel the need to confess this discomfort about my suspicion of the senators.
But why aren't we accepting her explanation? Her explanation, I think, was a signal to us that she told the story exactly how she wanted to tell it, that this was a contained thing, and that she actually sees it as behavior that's passing with a generation. That the fact that these are older guys, which nobody accepted and which got ignored as an explanation, seems to me a good explanation. Like, none of us think it was Paul Ryan, right? Like, you can't imagine, like, a guy who's under the age of 65 saying this kind of grandpa stuff. I like my girls chubby.
It did happen in the gym, though. And Paul Ryan, I'm sure, spends a lot of time in the Senate gym.
Exactly.
Oh, I guess he's in the House.
He's in the House. But I was like, you know, I mean, who's that's exactly what I thought. I thought, like, who's going to be thinking about fitness all the time? You know, but you can't, like, there was a similar scandal in Germany, I remember, when a 65-year-old member of Angela Merkel's cabinet said to some young reporter, oh, you really would fill a dirndl, you know, and
so what German. Every woman wants to hear.
Exactly. I know, she was so turned on. So anyway, it immediately came to mind because, like, that way of speaking, you wouldn't want to get porky. Like, it's just the guys look just kind of like relics at that moment. And immediately what you're thinking is like, oh, this kind of behavior is passing, you know. There is forms of harassment that if Kirsten Gillibrand had reported, my ears would prick up and I would say, wow, like, I can't believe that, you know, women in the Senate have to deal with this kind of thing. Like what Marin Kogan reported about, you know, young staffers. She's a political reporter and she wrote a story in the New Republic some time ago reporting how, you know, people would send her late night emails saying, like, you're fantastic. And, you know, things that were clear come-ons from staffers and people who were her sources. And that seemed to me very much like a problem we have to contend with, right. And that we continue to have to contend with, and that these guys need to learn that that behavior is totally unacceptable and inappropriate. But this thing that she was describing seems like, you know, can you really take it that seriously? And I just felt like, especially on the part of these male reporters, was a pylon of righteousness. Like, I'm the bigger feminist. No, I'm the bigger feminist.
Right. And some of the things that they said, like, this kind of behavior in a CEO would lead to a lawsuit. Or, and I think, really? Are you out of your mind? This is the kind of nonsense that people hear every day, and I didn't believe their attitudes were sincere for a moment, which is perhaps
I think you guys are like me. I think these are sort of cruel comments. I don't know. I think you
cruel comments because there are just any commenting on your body from another colleague makes you realize that this whole institution is condescending to you?
And it's incredibly inappropriate. She's also gotten, I mean, she's like a weird lightning rod for body issues. She had a profile in Vogue right after she'd lost the baby weight, and the author, like, it was so odd. It was just really fixated on her weight loss, and it was like, and now her younger husband, like, will pay attention to her. Like, that was literally a line that was published in Vogue. I mean, I think there's a weird kind of scrutiny when you are trying to be taken seriously, and probably being blonde and beautiful and now thin, like, helps her, but it also, I don't know, it makes a weird double standard, and I think she's getting singled out for a certain kind of attention that she doesn't want.
Yeah, I mean, I as I say, I feel really torn because, absolutely, you're right. There's something, I think it's an inbred cynicism that I can't quite shake because, she, you know, this is her book. She's trying to get attention for her book. She did this interview with People magazine. You know, I imagine that there's all kinds of policy prescriptions in her book, too. But, you know, I haven't heard any discussion of anything in the book except this little anecdote. And, I know I'm being cynical, but it just seems a little bit, I don't know, it's manufactured.
Well, she's also,
but is that her fault or is that our fault that she's written this entire book? The People magazine interview didn't even particularly focus on this. It wasn't a very long interview or story, but it was at the very end. And it's the only thing that we all have picked up. And I have to say, she does a lot for feminism. You know,
she
speaks at all sorts of conferences. She's kind of amazing as a figure in the Senate. And yet it's all about, you know, I like my girls chubby.
Exactly.
I also think she knew exactly what she was doing, in that now these guys know that they were being assholes, and they probably didn't before, but they'd have to be, you know, really blinded to realize now that it was not inappropriate or that it was inappropriate. She called them out. They know who they are. You know, probably other people they work with know who they are. Like the general public who's not in this club of 100 people, maybe we don't need to know.
Right, right.
I mean, I don't think any senators are like white knights.
If it was worse, I would really want to know. But in this one, I feel like it's enough that there's this, you know, there's this talk about it. They'll hear it, you know, and they'll realize they're morons, hopefully, because the people in the Senate are so smart and self-aware and always do the right thing.
So self-aware.
Right. OK, well, let's move on to our recommendations. June, you want to go first? What do you have for us today?
Well, I want to recommend kind of an old show. Showtime Anytime came to my particular cable lineup, so I was able to catch up with the Showtime shows that I had kind of, for no particular reason really, stopped watching. So I caught up with Nurse Jackie, and I was just reminded what an amazing show it is. The first four or so seasons I liked, but I kind of felt like it was getting in a rut. She was this brilliant nurse who was an addict and was just kept getting away with things. And finally, in seasons 5 and 6, they kind of moved away from that, and which I enjoyed, even though it was kind of hard to take that addict. I mean, who wants to watch a addict lie and cheat people? But the acting is amazing. Edie Falco does something that I've really only seen Bryan Cranston do reliably, where in sort of Breaking Bad, he could indicate that he was fooling people and they didn't know that they were being fooled, but we could see because his acting was slightly different. And she does something of the same in a very subtle way. The amazing Merritt Weaver is just fantastic in it. And I just think it's a show that doesn't really get the credit it deserves. It gets some Emmys, but in that kind of premium cable way, and I just fell in love with it all over again, and I think people should check it out.
Okay, so my recommendation for this week is the one I love, this Mark Duplass, Elizabeth Moss movie, which the Culture Gabfest talked about a week ago. It's such an interesting movie. It's a kind of Twilight Zone-y movie about marriage, and it has a lot of interesting thoughts and ideas about long-term marriage, and the Elizabeth Moss is really, really, really great. So I recommend, and it's eminently rentable. Like, you can just sit on your couch and watch it, even though it's also in theaters. So I think you all should. Noreen, what do you have for us?
I am on a constant quest for music to work to. I work in an open plan office, and it's very fun and social, and people are always coming to stop by and talk, but sometimes that's very distracting, and I get very bored with the stuff I'm listening to. So in the last couple weeks, I've discovered two artists to add to my arsenal of things to stream while working, and one is Banks, and the other is FKA Twigs. I don't know. It might be Fika Twigs. I don't know how the kids are pronouncing it. And they're both sort of like dreamy but forward moving is how I would describe them, which is what I basically look for in work music, unless it's classical music. And FKA Twigs, Fika Twigs, is apparently dating Robert Pattinson. So that's my like gossip tidbit for the day. But those are just and I think Banks has a new album coming out, and Fika Twigs, I can't decide how to pronounce her name, but she just had an album that came out, and both are good. Not too distracting.
You know what? Maybe we can do what we once did for the new female anthem, which is ask our listeners to email us a work music. What's your favorite work music? And we will compile a playlist and put it up. So if you have work music that you would like to recommend to Noreen so she can be even more productive than she already is, you can send us your suggestions to xxgabfest@slate.com, and we will soon compile them, or any other comments that you have about this show or suggestions for other things we can talk about. You can find more information about this show and also our recommendations at our show page, which is slate.com/XX. We would like to thank our new producer, Ann Hepperman, for masterminding this show and future shows, and thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. For Noreen and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.